All right, we're back, 2:15. So welcome, and please warmly welcome with me Lauren Martin.
Thank you. I would like to take a moment to thank the organizers for this excellent meeting. I myself actually am trained as a neuroscientist and find myself in the Department of Clinical Psychology. And not every future clinical psychologist wants to study neuroscience, and I find some of my students are interested in overlapping interests of my own that are peripheral to what I primarily do. And this series of studies that we've conducted over the past few years is an example of that. I was curious about particularly how Christians view life-extending technology, and had a couple of graduate students over the years who shared those interests. And so we put together these studies. As you can see here, try to move that so you can hear. This is something that's in the public's mind as well, right? This is something that is of interest as technology continues to improve our life expectancy. We've seen such a dramatic rise in life expectancy over the past 70 years, and it's projected to continue to increase from the current almost 78 years of age to a life expectancy possibly 8 years longer than that by 2050 is what the literature suggests. But you can see here from National Geographic in 2013, this baby will live to be 120. And then, of course, only 2 years later, we have on the cover of Time magazine, this baby could live to be 142 years old. Big rise in 2 years. But needless to say, this is something that is upon us and, you know, makes us wonder, is this something that the public really wants, and who wants it? And why do they want it? What are the factors that relate to life extension desirability? And that's really what we sought to answer. Of course, these are questions that people have been in search of for many years. Even Ponce de Leon, when he discovered Florida, was in search of the Fountain of Youth. And I can tell you, I've been to Florida, and it's nothing but... Some of you have been there as well. Some key concepts that I want to define here for life extension. These concepts, weak and strong life extension, were defined by Moody in 2002. A weak life extension is increasing the average life expectancy without increasing the lifespan. So for our purpose, we define this as living to the age of 100. Again, this is within the typical life span, which is a maximum of 120 years. Strong life extension is to increase life expectancy beyond the current lifespan estimate. So for our purposes, we define this as to live to an age of 150. And then finally, we added this indefinite life extension, this idea that you're increasing the lifespan an infinite number of years without any negative effects of aging. Now, this is different than immortality, right? Because you can still die accidental deaths, but not aging-related deaths. So in order to conduct these surveys that we did, first of all, we had to create some vignettes. And these vignettes were based upon some previous studies that were done. A pill was chosen. A pill is something that, in layman's terms, is easy to understand, even though those of us in areas of biotechnology recognize that a pill may not be really the means in which we may see some life-extending technology. But this is an example of a vignette that would be given. Imagine that a pill is made available that would increase your life expectancy to 100 years. If you are to take this pill, as you grow older from this point onward, you would not experience any further decline in age-related medical conditions. The pill only needs to be taken once and is easily affordable. You will only be offered this pill today and must decide whether you would like to use it now or not at all. Assume that if this pill was made widely available, there would be no social or economic repercussions. For example, a larger workforce, lack of job openings for younger generations, scarce resources, etc. So we gave this vignette, and then we gave a similar vignette for strong life extension, in which the life expectancy was now 150 years. And then we gave a third vignette for indefinite life extension, in which they would live an infinite number of years. We then had them respond, and we had two different types of responses that we were after. One, would they use this pill if it were offered to them? And we had a Likert scale ranging from strongly disagree to strongly agree. And then second, are they in support of research efforts dedicated toward developing this pill? Because it's a different question, right? It's one thing whether you would use the pill, it's another whether you would support research efforts in development of such pill. And we looked at a number of different variables as potential factors that would influence one's decision-making for life-extending technology. First of all, mortality salience vulnerability. This is pretty simple. We can look at age as a recognized and important factor for mortality salience. As one gets older, one's mortality becomes more salient. And we also had a Likert rating of physical health because we recognize that this is an important factor in mortality salience as well. We used a measure, the Quality of Life Enjoyment and Satisfaction Questionnaire short form. It's a well-validated measure for looking at quality of life, but in particular not physical health, but rather, you know, whether one is satisfied with their health, regardless of where their objective physical health might fall. Also measures quality of life in areas such as mood and leisure activities, social relationships, overall well-being. So this involved 16 items on this short form. We included the Death Attitude Profile Revised, and this measure, which was developed by Wong and others in 1994, involves 32 statements that measure death attitudes on a 7-point Likert scale. There are 5 different factors that are obtained from this. Fear of death, death avoidance, which were classified as negative death attitudes. And then we have approach-oriented death acceptance and escape-oriented death acceptance. Whereas, you know, one may approach death in a favorable way if you're looking towards a positive afterlife experience. That could be very different than somebody who's struggling in this life and looking at death favorably as an escape from the conditions of this life. These are both labeled as positive death attitudes. And then finally, we have neutral death acceptance, and we label that as a neutral death attitude. We included the spiritual belief scale, but only the religious subscale of the spiritual belief scale developed by Cicerelli in 2011. And there were 10 items on this scale. We included the God's will scale developed by Winter and others in 2009, measuring the willingness to defer to God's will through 5 different items. And then we developed our own afterlife beliefs. We had 3 Likert items in which we're measuring whether they believe in the existence of an afterlife, whether they believe that they will actually participate in the afterlife, and whether they believe that his or her experience of the afterlife will be a positive one. Because, you know, you may believe you're participating in an afterlife that wouldn't be positive, that wouldn't be something to look forward to. All right, so Allport and Ross in 1967 developed the idea of intrinsic and extrinsic religiosity, and Gorsuch and McPherson developed the scale of religiosity in 1989, in which they had 14 Likert items that measure an intrinsic orientation towards religion, an extrinsic personal orientation, and an extrinsic social orientation. So the idea being that the intrinsic oriented individuals are those who seek religious experiences, seek maybe going to church or worship experiences because they find it personally meaningful. It's important to them in their spiritual growth versus those who are going to seek it out for because they want to have community with others, which would be more of an extrinsic social as an example. So we included these items as well. And our first study, we recruited students. That, you know, it's a method of convenience for us. We had a group of 1,200 undergraduate and graduate students that were made available to us through a random selection process. Azusa Pacific University has around 10,000 total students, about evenly divided between graduate and undergraduate students. And so out of a group of 1,200, we got almost 200 to respond, 197. And they responded to an email invitation to complete this online survey. And as you can see, there were over 80 items in that survey, so it was quite extensive. Just to give you an example of some of the differences that we observed before I get into the second study. In this first study, we saw that certainly weak life extension was more desirable than strong life extension, and both were more desirable than indefinite life extension in this population. This is what we would predict. As one thinks about indefinite life extension, it does become less desirable. It's consistent with the literature as well. We do find some gender differences. We find that males across the board were, well, with the exception of the use of weak life extension, so extending your life within your life expectancy within the current lifespan. Here you can see the males on this side. I know this is hard to see. You can see the males here. This is use, and then this, the dotted lines are the research support. This is going to be strong use and research support, and this is indefinite use and research support. And here you can see the female responses here for use on weak, and then use of strong and research for strong, and then indefinite use and strength. So the only difference we did not observe was that for the use between males and females for weak life extension. So rather than like go through all of the results individually, and we've already published this in the Journal of Health and Religion, I thought it was best summarized through this slide. In particular, we have our three different forms of life extension here, and you can see here the death attitudes on this side. We've got approach acceptance and escape acceptance. We've got fear of death and death avoidance. The red lines indicate significant inverse relationships. The green lines indicate significant positive relationships. And in this initial study, which was composed of, again, a student population, so it's a younger population, we have some graduate students in that mix, but mostly it was undergraduate students that responded. We found that there were still quite a few significant relationships here. When it comes to the negative death attitudes, they were all positively related to indefinite life extension. We didn't see the relationships with weak or strong. I mentioned the differences of males over females for the strong and indefinite, but not for the use of weak. This is all use, not the research support, by the way. For the positive death attitudes, we find both approach acceptance and escape acceptance were related to the indefinite life extension as well in an inverse way, which again makes sense and kind of provides validation for what we're doing here. And when we look at the religious beliefs, we do find that it does matter, and in particular, the willingness to defer to God's will, it shows an inverse relationship with the use of these technologies. Meaning derived from religion also shows this inverse relationship with all three life-extending vignettes. And then we find the positive expectation of an afterlife shows inverse relationship, which is strong and indefinite. For intrinsic religiosity, we also found inverse relationships with strong and indefinite. For the extrinsic religiosity, both personal and social, we did not find any relationship with these life-extending technologies. So for that first summary, just to kind of put it together, we've got desire facilitating factors, males more than females, all negative death attitudes, negative death affect, and then we have desire hindering factors. We've got females less than males, all positive death attitudes, positive death affect, deference to God's will, meaning found in religion, belief of positive afterlife participation, and intrinsic religiosity. So we weren't satisfied after this initial study, even though we found it meaningful, and my student did an exceptional job, I felt, in putting together the study overall. But we wanted to do a follow-up, and so I had another graduate student who came along and also expressed interest in this area. In particular, she was interested in gerontology, and so she endeavored to recruit participants who were in the aging population. And so for this approach, we used two different methods of collection. First of all, we used a marketing service to actually just send out our survey via mail. We had 112 surveys that were returned through that process. This is all in a population that was 65 years of age or older. And then this particular student went to senior centers and actually lived in a senior living community for several weeks in a summer, and really established rapport and was able to then collect 167 surveys in person through these experiences. And I think that was a very valuable process for her, and proved to be invaluable to our data collection process. So once again, when we look at the overall differences in life extension desirability, the weak life extension was preferred over strong, and indefinite falls the lowest on the list of desirability here, as one would anticipate. When we look at the gender differences here, we found that, once again, the males tended to desire life-extending use more so than females. And you see that, I don't know why this is messing up, but you can see that here with the weak life extension use, the strong life extension use. We didn't see it in the indefinite life extension use, but we did see it with the indefinite research. And so there's a clear difference in both studies between males and females when it comes to life extending technology. For Christians versus non-Christians, Now, this was something that we weren't able to address in the initial study because even though as an evangelical Christian institution of higher education, we have an open enrollment policy. We tend to have mostly Christian students, and our sample reflected that. It was, I think, around 95% overall. And even in the second approach that we used with the aging population, we found 82% of the population were Christian that responded. You know, part of that could be the actual senior centers and where they were located that we targeted. But regardless, we were able to get a comparison between Christian and non-Christian populations. We weren't able to look deeper in the non-Christian populations to try to tease out other religions. And that's something that we'd love to do in the future. But I will say that this is the third study that has looked at life extension technology desirability and has shown the significant difference between a non-Christian and Christian population, which is interesting. Those other prior studies also did not tease out the non-Christian population. And one of them took place in Australia by Underwood, and another was in the United States by Cicerelli. So overall, we find desire for weak, strong, and not indefinite use, but indefinite research is higher in the non-Christian population over the Christian population. When we look at age, now we're able to see differences in age that we weren't able to see in the population of mostly college-age students. Here we find that there were no differences based on age for the weak life extension vignettes, but there were for the strong. This is young old, middle old, and old old. That's what that stands for. Believe it or not, these are the actual technical terms that are used within the field of gerontology. I question that coming outside of the field myself and getting into this literature. I'm like, are you sure this is correct? And I had to look it up for myself when my graduate student first presented it to me. But anyway, we find that the young olds, which is defined as those aged 65 to 74, preferred strong life extension use over those who were middle old and old old. Middle old being those who are 75 to 84, and old old those who are 85 plus. When we also looked at educational differences, something that we weren't able to do in our college sample, we really had, I mean, even though we had some grad students and some undergrads, here we have those who had some grad school to a college graduate, to some college, to a high school graduate, to below high school. And we're able to see that there is a clear educational difference when it comes to the use of these life-extending technologies, especially for weak life extension use and weak life extension research support. So finally, we have this slide here that summarizes the many different findings similar to study one, this time in study two. And you can see here now, whereas in study one, we didn't see as many significant relationships in this more sizable and more broadly distributed population. We see many more relationships than we had in the first study. We have yet to publish this. My student just defended this recently for her dissertation. But you can see here, when it comes to death attitudes, now we have across the board positive relationships between negative death and all three forms of life extension. We also have, for the positive death affect, we have the inverse relationships between weak and strong for approach acceptance. For overall positive death attitude, escape acceptance only with weak. For religious beliefs, we've got meaning derived from religion, we've got positive expectation of the afterlife, and we have intrinsic religiosity over here, all inversely related to weak, strong, and indefinite life extension. And then for demographics, where we were able to previously look at like males versus females, now we're able to look at non-Christians, we're able to look at age as a factor, and we're looking at education as a factor, and all of these are relating in a positive way to life extension desirability.
Could you take questions soon?
Yeah. So that basically summarizes our second study. I've got kind of the summary listed here. I'll just kind of close out with a comparison between the studies and then take some questions. You can see here that we have online completion of surveys versus in-person or via mail. We've got 197 to 279, both sizable samples, but this average age over here is 24.27 versus 77.08. We excluded the God's Will scale. We were trying to pare back for our aging population the number of items on the survey, so we excluded this. We found that this related to some of the other scales that we were using anyway. But here we were able to include some additional demographic information. And this is just a summary of some of the differences between the two. There are certainly some limitations of these studies. The different survey administration methods, the mostly white sample in particular of the aging population, we actually had 94% of our respondents were non-Hispanic white. Compare that with our college-aged sample, which was 60%. We didn't see any racial differences in the college-age sample. Would have been interesting to see if we saw that in the aging population, if we had a broader sample there. And then the mostly Christian sample, even in the aging population, 82% who identified as Christian. So, as you can see, that this is something that is of current interest to many different areas. This recent study that was published is looking at physicians and how their level of religiosity, psychological factors, and ethical concerns were found to affect their decisions to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment. So it's not necessarily just our own personal perspectives that are important here, but also our healthcare providers and how they weigh in on this decision making. And that's everything I have to present. I'll open up to some questions, but I just wanted to highlight my two recent graduate students, Dr. Scott Ballinger and Dr. Kelsey Fitzgerald, who completed these studies. Yes?
Do you have any measure of whether any component of depression or use of any depressive medications was involved in any of these, in particularly the elderly study?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, we would have loved to include Beck's depression inventory or a similar measure, but we were limited by the number of items that we already had. We thought the quality of life questionnaire actually gets to that, but when you're looking at the amount of enjoyment that one gets out of life, it can kind of provide a proxy for depression through that. So that was one way that we could rule that out, so to speak, or look at the relationship of depression.
In the older study, did you see any difference between the ones who somehow self-selected by mailing back the questionnaire versus the ones that were in person?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I actually have that on the slide with limitations. I had to skip through real quickly, but we did see a difference. It didn't impact the overall results, but we saw a significant difference in those who submitted in person tended to have a higher level of life extension desirability, and probably relates to that social impact of like sitting down with someone to complete a survey and thinking in terms of being primed more socially, right? And thinking maybe in terms of the social consequences of not being alive. So I think that's a factor. It'd be interesting to dig a little deeper into just the presence of the other and how that weighs in on decision making.
Thank you.
I'm sure that Lauren would be happy to talk further during the break. Is there a last question in our formal session?
Yes.
People that were going to live for, not to live indefinitely, without age, were they assuming that they would be a relative few, or that the rest of the world might do this too? Because I think I have to do the math, and if rabbits, bred like rabbits, would never die, it would take 12 years for every square foot to have a rabbit.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, keep in mind in the vignette, we included that there wouldn't be, a scarcity of resources or jobs. So there is an assumption that what you're doing is not selfish. You know, that we're trying to state it in a way that they can see that they're not taking from someone else. You're not taking a job from someone else. You're not taking resources from someone else in that scenario.
Well, thank you to Lauren Martin and again to Vincent Lynch.